Hello and welcome to Talking Bach. My name is Madeline Easton and I am the founder and artistic director of Bach Academy Australia. I started this podcast back in 2022 in order to connect with our audience a little bit more, but more so to offer you different insights into Bach that you wouldn't necessarily get from attending a concert or tuning in on the Australian Digit Concert Hall. This podcast also gives me the chance to interview guests from all over the world who have a special relationship with Bach. We've had performers of Bach such as countertenor Russell Harcourt and Julia Fredersdorf, performers who are also academics such as Judy Tarling, the author of that amazing book, The Weapons of Rhetoric. We've had academics such as the world-famous Bach expert and president of the Bach Archive in Leipzig, Dr. Peter Wolny. We've had child psychologist Dr. Brendan New, highly regarded King's Counsel Jonathan Horton QC. We've had medical journalist Dr. Norman Swan, who was enormously helpful during the pandemic. And also people like the Indigenous composer and performer Troy Russell, to name but a few. Each and every one of these remarkable people have a deep understanding both of their particular fields of study, but also of Bach's music, its effect, meaning and reach. All these conversations have been absolutely fascinating for myself and are all available on demand for you via your chosen streaming platform. This episode of Talking Bach is hosted by yours truly, myself. The topic of discussion today is our upcoming program, Bach the Benefactor, that opens on Friday the 12th of April and runs till Sunday the 11th of April 2024, right here in Sydney. For myself, there is so much to talk about here and much that I hope you will also find deeply fascinating, not only musically, but also historically. So, let's get into it. Why did I call this concert series Bach the Benefactor? Well, I've been doing some thinking. What does it mean to be a benefactor? What does that word actually mean? Well, bene or bonum means good in Latin, and factum means to make or to do. So the word benefactor literally means to do good. Having read so much about Bach's life, his extremely humble beginnings, being orphaned at the age of 9, being sent off to live with his much older brother who he hardly knew in a totally different town, having to go off to work at 16 years old as his family couldn't afford to feed or house him anymore, I mean, it's pretty evident to me that this was not an entitled individual. Many at that time may have eked out a living as a jobbing musician in his position, as the previous four generations of Bach musicians had. However, Johann Sebastian Bach was a very different person. He possessed something very different, and in my opinion, that was his mind, his intellect, his insatiable curiosity and his sheer bloody-minded determination. The key thing here, though, is that he could have been just extremely determined to be a world-famous performer, as he ended up being, ironically, but that wasn't his aim, I think, anyway. No one could possibly doubt his faith, and this is the key. His Lutheranism and his faith were at the heart of everything he did and was that the motivation for every single decision in his life. He seemed to know by instinct that a life lived in service of his God through music was the way forward. His way to be a better person, a better musician, a better husband, a better father and teacher, it was not about him. Bach detested any kind of posturing, arrogance, self-importance and anything superficial. Don't get me wrong, like he knew his worth, okay, and was well known for being hot-headed and short-tempered when trying to attain better employment for himself or see justice done as a youth. Actually, if any of you are interested in reading more about who Bach was as a person and what were his motivations, I can very much recommend these two books. The first is by Sir John Eliot Gardner, and it's his award-winning biography on Bach titled Music in the Castle of Heaven. The second is by the American author and historian James Gaines and is titled An Evening in the Castle of Heaven. This book is not so much a biography, but it describes the night that Johann Sebastian Bach met King Frederick the Great of Prussia on the 7th of May 1747. Now, this is where the old world collided violently with the new. I have never read a book which gets to the heart of Bach's personality and beliefs as this one, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. So, it is my fundamental belief that every moment of Bach's life, when he wasn't managing a huge family and rounding up rowdy boys at the Thomasschule, was dedicated to doing good for his family, students, the wider community, and all those who came after. Now, whether he knew it or not, I believe he was a benefactor to all and continues to be for those whose ears and eyes and hearts are open to him and his music. And now to the music. So, for this next concert series, I have programmed three works. Opening our concert is Bach's cantata, BWV 39, Brich dem Hungrigen dein Brot. You will immediately be thinking, well, that sounds something like being hungry and bread, and you'd be right. The first line of this cantata translates as, break with hungry men thy bread, or give the hungry ones thy bread. There is so much to say about this cantata, I actually hardly even know where to start. But I'll tell you where I first came across it, and that was at a dinner party where, after a few bottles of wine, the conversation turned to Bach cantatas. I was obviously very happy about this turn of events. And then the host said, have you heard Bach's Refugee Cantata? And I said, well, hang on, what? Is there a Refugee Cantata? What's that all about? And then the work was duly put on the stereo and we all listened and I was absolutely transfixed. It was described as a musical representation of the footsteps of the Protestant refugees as they entered Leipzig, having been expelled by the Catholic court of Salzburg. The first thing that struck me was those block chordal passages that could not be mistaken for anything else but the breaking of bread to feed the hungry along the journey. Here is the opening of that cantata so you can hear exactly what I mean. So you heard there the opening chorus of Bach's cantata BWV 39, played by the English Baroque soloists and the Monteverdi Choir under the direction of Sir John Eliot Gardner. It's amazing, isn't it? There was really no greater master of word painting than Bach. So after that, I said to our host, yes, I hear it. I hear those footsteps and the breaking of the bread. Anyway, fast forward a few months and then the devastating invasion of Ukraine by Russia began. All our television screens, phones, news outlets and such began filling with images of terrified Ukrainian refugees desperate to flee bombs and terror raining down on them. It was utterly heartbreaking and so, so, so sad. That Bach cantata, the refugee cantata, came to mind around then, and I remember putting it on and sort of weeping. No, not sort of, actually genuinely weeping, as that music, as you just heard, is so utterly haunting and beautiful, but also extremely consoling. Now, that's not new for Bach cantatas. They are all consoling in their own way. There is Bach, once again, knowing what you need to hear in that particular moment, and he had just the piece for me at that time. It was also around this time that I had to start programming for 2024. So I thought, what better time to program this incredible work? Not only so Sydney audiences and also anyone tuning in around the world via the Australian Digital Concert Hall can hear it live, but also I wanted to draw a parallel between the world of the 1730s and the world of the 2020s. Wars are still happening. Refugees are still fleeing. It's still happening. And sadly, nothing has changed. Now, before we get all too depressed here, there is still so much to say about hope. Now that comes in the form of what we can do as individuals in the face of having absolutely no sway over government actions. Actually, save our votes. That's the one thing we have. And thank God we have those because so, you know, lots of other people aren't so lucky, are they? Now, fast forward to April 2024. And sadly, Ukraine is still enduring an invasion. And very sadly, many more millions of innocent people are now fleeing bombs and violent oppression worldwide than were doing so in 2023. So this work actually seems even more relevant to us here and now than ever. The thing is, it was not written for the occasion I mentioned before. How very convenient, though, if it were. What a brilliant story it would have made if Bach had written this piece for the arrival of the refugees. But before I go on, I want to tell you a little bit about the history that we're talking about, at what happened when these Protestants were expelled out of Salzburg. So the Salzburg Protestants, in German, Salzburger Exulanten, were Protestant refugees who had lived in the Catholic archbishopric of Salzburg until the 18th century. In a series of persecutions ending in 1731, over 20,000 Protestants were expelled from their homeland by the prince archbishops. Their expulsion from Salzburg triggered protests from the Protestant states within the Holy Roman Empire and criticisms across the rest of the Protestant world. So the King of Prussia offered to resettle them in his territory. The majority of the Salzburg Protestants accepted the Prussian offer and travelled the length of Germany to reach their new homes in Prussian Lithuania. The rest scattered to the British colonies in America and, importantly for us, the other Protestant states in Europe, i.e. Saxony. Now, I just read that direct from Wikipedia, by the way. So here is the reality of Bach's composition. It does not fit so conveniently into the narrative that he wrote it to welcome the refugees into Leipzig, despite the words telling us that it may have. I mean, it's often thought that Bach did compose this cantata as an ode and a welcome for these refugees. Given the text and the sentiments of sharing what you have with the needy, it made perfect sense, and history duly dubbed this work the Refugee Cantata. And it might well have been performed at the time, but sadly we have no proof of it. Now, in recent years, scholars such as Alfred Duhr, Christoph Wolff, and Konrad Kuster managed to date the cantata precisely and thus prove it was composed in Leipzig for the first Sunday after Trinity, which was the 23rd of June, 1726, a full 7 years before the Protestants were expelled out of Salzburg, making it part of Bach's third cycle of Leipzig cantatas. Now, back to the music. Putting the date of composition aside for a moment, it is a hands-down masterpiece of composition and shows a composer at the very heights of their power. Here's a little bit about the text of the cantata, taken from Alfred Duhr's amazing book, The Cantatas of Bach. The text is often associated with the Sunday Gospel. The librettists of earlier cantatas of this Sunday placed the poverty-wealth antitheses, or the call for repentance in the face of eternity, in the centre of their deliberations. The librettist of the text, however, sees in the parable of the rich man and the poor Lazarus a demand of active help on behalf of one's fellow human beings and gratitude for God's gifts. The libretto is drawn from recently rediscovered cycle, largely uniform in layout, whose texts were set on a number of occasions by both Bach and his Meinigen cousin Johann Ludwig Bach. Both parts of the word are introduced by a biblical text. The Old Testament words that open part one are attached to the injunction to love one's neighbour. The New Testament words of part two to an expression of gratitude of gifts received, to the vow to cultivate love of one's neighbour, and to the prayer that one day I myself will be received with compassion by God. The concluding chorale, the sixth verse of the hymn, Kommt, lass euch den Herren lehren, by David Denniker from 1648, brings all these ideas together once more. Well, I hope you got all of that. It's a very, very, very intense text, but it does kind of encapsulate what this cantata is all about. The cantata is completely symmetrical, being seven movements long, and is a shining example of the most ingenious expressive word painting to be found in any music. It is scored for three vocal soloists, soprano, alto, and bass, two recorders, two oboes, strings, and continuo. The work begins with an opening chorus on an impressive scale. It's 218 bars long, and it demonstrates perfectly all Bach had learned and perfected thus far as a composer in his career. He borrows from the motet, actually, by employing the device of a series of passages for the different portions of the text, thus creating perfect musical settings for each grammatical sentence. All of this happens within a much larger structure of three big sections. The middle of these is shorter and more chordal, creating a more subdued texture, but perfectly balances the outer, more fugal sections. The truly remarkable feature of this opening symphonia is for me those block chordal sequences I mentioned before, which are interspersed with rests and passed between the various instrumental groups, which is amazing to watch on stage, actually. So by writing this way, Bach manages to perfectly depict in sound and gesture the breaking of bread. It's a very deeply moving oral depiction of a plea to give what you can, and if you do, you will be blessed. The rest of the cantata goes from aria to recitative in a beautiful way. but it's all concluded with this fantastic chorale in B-flat major, tenderly set to the melody of Freu dich sehr, or Meine Seele, a perfect vehicle to express the text, Blessed are they who out of mercy attend to the affliction of strangers and are compassionate to the poor. Here is that beautiful last chorale for you to listen to. I hope you'll agree that it is one of the most beautiful chorales in all music and such a beautiful and tender way to end this work. Here we see Bach being a benefactor to his fellow citizens, reminding them that if you give what you can to those more in need than yourself, you are truly blessed. And so, to the next work. We have been talking about Bach as a benefactor to his chosen city of Leipzig, but what of his students? He had so many over his 45 odd years as a professional musician. But what stands out to me is his passion for doing the very best he could by them all the time. Their education was incredibly important to Bach, as is well documented. Those students included his own children as well. Through his dedicated efforts, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, Wilhelm Friedemann Bach, Johann Christoph Friedrich Bach, and Johann Christian Bach all became successful and famous musicians in their own right. That's kind of an amazing legacy. Their father was always thinking of better and more effective ways of instructing his students and wrote so much music for them. Some examples of this are his 6 little preludes for beginners and 15 two-part inventions, both of which Bach wrote during the lesson for a particular pupil and afterwards improved them into beautiful and expressive compositions. Also, we have, of course, the Anna Magdalena Buchlein that contains some of the most famous pieces of Bach that have delighted children throughout the centuries, myself included in Suzuki Book 1. So what was Bach like as a teacher? Well, I'm going to let Mr. Nicholas Forkel, Bach's first and arguably most famous biographer, do the talking for me. Nicholas Forkel says, and I quote, "It not infrequently happens that talented composers and players are incapable of imparting their skills to others. Either they have never troubled to probe the mechanisms of their own facility or, through the excellence of their instructors, have taken the shortcut to proficiency and allowed their teacher and not only their judgment decide how a thing should be done. Such people are useless to instruct beginners. True, they may succeed in teaching the rudiments of technique, assuming that they have been properly taught themselves, but they are certainly unqualified to teach in the full sense of the word. There is, in fact, only one way to become a good teacher, and that is to have gone through the discipline of self-instruction, a path along which the beginner may go astray 1,000 times before attaining perfection. For it is just this stumbling effort that reveals the dimensions of the art of teaching. The man who has adventured it learns the obstacles that obstruct his path and how to surmount them. To be sure, it is a lengthy method, but if a man has patience to persevere, he will reap sure reward after an alluring pilgrimage. No musician ever founded a school of his own who has not followed such a course, and his experience, his teaching has owed its distinctive character. This is so with Bach, who, only gradually discovering his full stature, was 30 years old before unremitting application raised him above the difficulties of his art. But he reaped his reward. Self-discipline set him on the fairest and most alluring path that it has ever been given to a musician to tread. To teach well, a man needs to have a full mind. He must have discovered how to meet and have overcome the obstacles in his own path before he can be successful in teaching others how to avoid them. Bach united both qualities. Hence, as a teacher, he was the most instructive, clear, and definite that has ever been. In every branch of his art, he produced a band of pupils who followed in his footsteps, without, however, ever equaling his achievement. First of all, let me show you how he taught the clavier. To begin with, his pupils were first made to acquire the special touch of which I have already spoken. To that end, for months together, he made them practice nothing but simple exercises for the fingers of both hands, at the same time emphasizing the need for clearness and distinctness. He kept them at these exercises for 6 to 12 months, unless he found his pupils losing heart, in which case he so far met them as to write short studies which incorporated a particular exercise. Of this are the 6 little preludes for beginners and the 15 two-part inventions, both of which Bach wrote. Not until this stage was reached did Bach allow his pupils to practice his own larger work, so admirably calculated, as he knew, to develop their powers. In order to lessen the difficulty, it was his excellent habit to play over to them the pieces they were to study, with the remark, "That's how it ought to sound." That's funny. It would be difficult to exaggerate the helpfulness of this method. The pupil's interest was roused by hearing the piece played properly, but that was not the sole result. Without the help thus given, the pupil could not only hope to overcome the difficulties of the piece after considerable effort, and would find it much less easy to realize a proper rendering of it. As it was, he received at once an ideal aim to aim for, and was taught how to surmount the difficulties the piece represented. Many a young performer, still imperfect after years of practice, probably would master his music in a month if he once had played it over to him. That's what Nicholas Forkel said about Bach's teaching. Pretty incredible, I think. Now, for me, there was a dedicated teacher, which is pretty incredible when you consider how many children Bach had and his huge responsibilities composition-wise at both the Nicolai and the Thomas churches in Leipzig. Now, what he also did, though, was to arrange his works for students, most of all his concertos. All those concertos he wrote whilst in Curtin, he took with him up to Leipzig, although sadly many of the original manuscripts don't survive and were lost. But he arranged them for all sorts of different instrumental combinations. Now, lucky for him, when he arrived in Leipzig, he discovered a ready-made, fully functioning concert society called the Collegium Musicum, handily formed by Georg Telemann in 1701. Here, he had a fantastic platform to perform his own works, but also to give his students performance opportunities which would only improve and instruct them. And there you have our benefactor. Once again, Bach is looking out for any and all opportunities to look out for his students, to do what he could for the benefit of them. Bene, there's that word, good. If that's not being a benefactor, I don't know what is. And being a teacher myself, I hugely understand this, actually. Now, this tradition is alive and well today thanks to the great work of music teachers worldwide. So next weekend, I will be performing a violin concerto as our second work in the program, arranged in just this tradition by one of the world's greatest living violin teachers, Kati Debreczeni. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this amazing woman. Born in Transylvania, Kati Debreczeni studied the violin with Ora Shiran in Israel and the Baroque violin with Catherine McIntosh and Walter Reiter at the Royal College of Music in London. Since the year 2000, she has led the English Baroque soloists, and her playing can be heard on their recordings, including the Bach Cantata Pilgrimage. In 2008, she was appointed as one of the leaders of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, with whom she has often appeared as soloists, directing and leading the orchestra in performances in the UK, Europe, and the US. Kati has recorded numerous chamber music CDs with the ensembles Florilegium, Ricordo, and Trio Goya. Additionally, she features as soloists on 2 versions of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, one with the European Brandenburg Ensemble under Trevor Pinnick, and the other with the English Baroque Soloists. Cutty has directed various ensembles in Israel, Canada, Norway, Poland, Iceland, and the UK. She currently teaches the Baroque and Classical Violin at the Royal Conservatory of the Music in The Hague. If that isn't an impressive CV, I don't know what is. And being the concertmaster of the English Baroque Soloists, all those cantatas, all those amazing cantatas that they recorded, that's her playing in those ravishingly beautiful obbligato solos. She is one of the world's absolute best, and I am deeply privileged to know her and call her a colleague and a friend. Cutty is actually producing some of the world's best students right now, and she's also doing her absolute best to help them into the profession and produce material that will help them. And her arrangement of Bach's Harpsichord Concerto in E, BWV 1053, is a living example of the continuation of Bach's tradition of arranging his works for his students. It must have been insanely difficult to do, but she has done an amazing job of it, and I am loving preparing it. Thank you, Cutty, for all that you do as a benefactor for your students and custodian of this incredible music. Now, just so that you can hear a bit of Cutty's incredible arrangement and playing also, I'm going to play you the first movement of the concerto, BWV 1053.
Thank you.
wonderful piece and I get the chance to play it. I'm so excited. Now, on to our final piece in our program, Bach the Benefactor. Why have I programmed Bach's cantata, BWV 147, Herz und Mund und Tat und Leben? Well, for me, it is in the meaning of those words. Translated, they mean heart and mouth and deed and life. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a sentence that so perfectly expresses a way to live one's life for optimal happiness. I didn't always know this work. I only knew the famous chorale that we now know as Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. In fact, I'm ashamed to say I didn't even know it was from a cantata. I played that chorale countless times at weddings, funerals, events, you name it. It was in our gig pads and it got trotted out at all such occasions alongside, you know, the Queen of Sheba, Pachelbel's Canon, the Four Seasons, Eine Kleine, etc., etc. But it was only after discovering the cantatas in Europe in my 20s that the origin of that work became clear. And, oh my gosh, I mean, discovering the cantatas was one thing, but discovering this cantata, it's a huge one. It's just over half an hour long, and then it's in two parts, stretching to 10 movements. It's massive and it's amazing. So just to give you a taster of this, I'd like to play you a little bit of the opening chorus. Beginning. I love it so much. It's amazingly jubilant, triumphant, and in C major too. What a key. So let me tell you a little bit about this work. Originally composed in 1716 as an Advent cantata in Weimar, Bach reworked it for the Mariam Feast of the Visitation on the 2nd of July 1723, Bach's first year in Leipzig. From the first note, Bach evokes a mood of jubilation, warmth, strength and heart by employing trumpet, oboe and full strings. Always with an eye for symbolism and symmetry, Bach manages to divide all the text into three sections, no doubt as a nod to the Trinity. The text was adapted to refer to the visitation, an acknowledgement of Jesus by Mary, in this case, whose word recount the wonders of God in her song of praise, the Magnificat. We are really fortunate in this case that Bach's autograph score actually survives. And in that score, you can see a really rare alteration where he used Salomo Frank's text and then thought better of it and he scribbled it out and changed it to the more positive version, Mein Heiland erwähle die gläubenden Seele. My Saviour, choose the believing soul. This cantata is magnificently festive in character. It uses a trumpet, oboes, bassoon, strings, continuo and choir. The opening chorus is marvellously symmetrical, a hallmark of Bach's, utilising all lines of text throughout what could be described as a da capo. Interspersed are highly unusual a cappella moments. It's really strange that the orchestra is going along and then the choir singing and then suddenly everything stops and there's just the choir. It's like the ground drops out from underneath you. It's very effective, actually. The cantata works its way along its journey through aria and recit, with beautiful obbligato violin solo and a beautiful oboe demoro solo, and in the second half, an incredible trumpet solo. But what really marks this cantata are those two chorales that bookend parts 1 and 2. They are musically identical, however differ in text. Now, whilst the choir sings a plain four-part chorale, albeit in 9/8 time, which is normally what you'd get from a jig, what you get is almost a pastoral feel with this beautiful triplet figure underneath the chorale melody. when I started analysing this, I couldn't believe it, but Bach amazingly cleverly embeds the chorale on the first note of each triplet. You would never know it to look at it, but when you start to have a look at it, it reveals itself. Anyway, the chorale is deeply reverent and tender, and it's a very special way to end such a substantial cantata, and one that has endured with astonishing popularity ever since. And I'd just like to play you the very end of this cantata, as it's so beautiful. Wonder it's endured so much throughout the centuries. So many have been influenced by it, from Dame Myra Hess's amazing arrangement of it in 1726, which, by the way, is responsible for why we call that cantata Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. She actually translated the words from German and made that German sentence, and that's the only reason we know it as Jesu Joy, thanks to Dame Myra Hess. Her arrangement of that cantata became so popular, it catapulted this cantata into the popular space, the popular hearing. Since 1926, through innumerable instrumentalists arranging it from their instruments, through to the Beach Boys in their song Lady Linda. Yes, you heard that right, the Beach Boys. It has been played time and time again. Just to prove I'm not making that up, here's a little bit of Lady Linda. So as you can see, that chorale has made it into the popular consciousness of our music. But it's more than a popular tune, isn't it? I mean, here is Bach once again writing a work that in a way serves as a lesson to us all. Now, what could that lesson be? I think It's to live our lives listening to our hearts, using our mouths, taking the opportunity to do good through our deeds, and as a consequence, living our lives honoring each other. We as humans have so much love, and I really believe Bach loved humanity. He always held hope, and you can hear that in his music. I feel extremely strongly that with every note that he wrote, he has somehow gained the ability to reach out to us through time and touch us, as if we just let him in, he can be a benefactor in that way to all of us. It's my belief that these three works could not exemplify better Bach's desire to be a benefactor, which is why I've chosen them. And he knew that those who heard these works and allowed themselves to be affected by them would be all the richer, both physically and spiritually. BWV 147 is a perfect musical metaphor for how Bach believed one should live one's life through heart, mind, deed, and life. He knew better than most that a life lived in service was a life well lived, filled with meaning and personal satisfaction. What Bach gave us is an enduring legacy of work written to make our lives better and give hope for a better future. I could not think of a better benefactor than that. I hope you've learned a little bit about the works that we'll be performing at our next concert series, and also, as always, a little bit more about Bach himself. I hope to see you there on Friday, April 12th at St. Francis of Assisi Church in Paddington, 7:30 p.m., and on Sunday the 14th at Our Lady of Dolores Church in Chatswood, 2:30 p.m. For those of you who can't make it in person, you can join us for the live stream through the Australian Digital Concert Hall. For in-person tickets, jump on our website, www.bachacademyaustralia.com.au. I'm Madeline Easton. Thank you once again, and see you next time for our next installment of Talking Bach.